I think first and foremost, gratitude should go to Mr. Anthony for being here, present here today. Everyone else at the school has been given time off for the end of the year, but he has chosen to be here with us to help set everything up. So perhaps we can take a moment to give our blessings to him and his family. When everyone else has taken time out, and yet he has decided to be here on the invitation of school's management to help us conduct the sermon today. You don't know him by his name? You don't know who Miss Anthony is? You do? Anthony, yeah? He's a gentleman who comes and sets up the audio for us. These are the unsung heroes, and he's not even a Buddhist. Who's a Buddhist after all? Is it someone who's born to Buddhist parents? Is that what we call a Buddhist? I wasn't a Buddhist until I heard the Dhamma, but I was born to Buddhist parents. Buddhism is a religion. But a Buddhist is not necessarily someone who is born to Buddhist parents. It is who you become. It is who you become through noble association. So, our utmost gratitude and regard to him and his family. May the new year bring him and his family good health and prosperity. And also a huge thank you to the school management. We were to-ing and fro-ing whether we should be doing this sermon here today or at the monastery over the last couple of weeks. But in the end, for your convenience, because whenever we do it at the monastery, it's a long trek for you all the way up to Ingiriya. But for your convenience, they decided in the end to have it here in Rajagiriya. Because next week you'll be at the monastery anyway. 3 weeks at a stretch to Ingiriya probably would have been a bit too much for all of you. So they were very kind to open the school up just for this today. Nothing else is going on at the school. And how much do they charge you for it? That's the thing. These things are priceless, ladies and gentlemen. Compassion is priceless. You can't put a price tag on it. People think that everything has a price tag. Not when you understand the purpose behind why we do these things. You can buy people for money, but you can't buy humanity for money. That cannot be bought. You can buy a man's time, but you can't buy his heart, not for money. And aren't we all living proof of that? In yesterday's sermon at the monastery, I was talking about Maitri Handru. Give me a show of hands if you were there yesterday. The usual faces. I was talking about Maitri Handru, and I'll just remind you a little bit about his story before we proceed. Maitri Handru used to be a physicist and a mathematician. His name was Mr. Daniel. You know who I'm talking about, right? Yes. Germany Maitri Thero. He was Mr. Daniel before he ordained with us. He was a very well respected and highly regarded individual. And he was also a seeker of the truth. Being a physicist, and a very good physicist, a highly trained and skilled mathematician, he was lecturing at his university, having completed his master's, on his way to become a PhD doctor in his field, at the time he discovered the Dhamma. So I asked the audience yesterday a question. Could you not have hired him as a lecturer, as a scientist, as a physicist? Mr. Daniel, you could have hired him. And for the service he would have rendered, you would have been able to remunerate him. But that was only Mr. Daniel. But now he's Maitri Hamdru. Can you hire him? How much would you have to pay? How much could you pay to hire him? You can't hire him anymore. He's not available for rent. Mr. Daniel could have been hired, but not Maitri Hamdru. Because the price of what he has to offer now is not something that anyone could afford. Because now he gives out of pure love and out of pure compassion. And that is not something that can be bought. It comes from within. And that is why yesterday morning, he and the other Buddha from Germany, who was at the monastery, they boarded a flight to Germany, and they'll be spending New Year as well as the first 2 months of the New Year in Germany, spreading the love and compassion that he found in Sri Lanka, amongst you, amongst his teachers at the monastery, sharing the Dhamma that he learnt with his fellow men and women in the land that was once the place of his birth, as well as where he learnt what he needed to learn. So now he's in Germany. So if you have friends and any family or distant cousins, relations in Germany, then Maitri Hamdru is there. So please get in touch with the monastery and we can most certainly put you in touch with the tour that he's doing right now. So if there's any friends or any relations of yours there, then they can benefit out of it as well. What the sasana did to Maitri Hamdru was it made him priceless. It made him timeless, made him someone that can no longer be bought with cash or anything else that is of material wealth, material value. And it's the same thing that's happening with all of you. This is the same thing happening with all of you, ladies and gentlemen. I always say, with the Dhamma, you become a blessing to everyone. Initially, you are only a blessing to yourself. But as the Dhamma heals you, and as the Dhamma helps you expand yourself, broaden your horizons, begins to melt you from within, so that you are no longer a self, but someone that belongs to the entire universe. As your heart grows, and the whole world, you have enough room in your heart to fit the whole world in it, then you become a man of the world. Truly, truly someone who cares selflessly. And once that happens, then there's nothing in this world that can be exchanged for your time. There's nothing in this world that can be exchanged for your compassion, your love and your commitment. You become a truly priceless individual. How much is the Venerable Sariputta there? What is the price that you can put on him? This is how you become priceless, through the sasana. So, for that, we are gathered here today, to become individuals who become priceless, not just to us or our families or our workplaces. If you can expand yourself to become a mother, a father to the whole world, a brother and a sister to the whole world, so that you can love everyone in this world just as you love your own child. You know, as parents, how you love your own children. And that is a love that cannot be measured in any way. You know that love cannot be surmounted in any way. If you can expand and extend that love universally, that day that you can do that is the day that you have become an arahant. It's a long stretch. It's not easy. I've never said that it was easy. But it's doable. Perhaps right now you can't even fathom how that's even possible. Because when you see your child amongst a group of children, your child is always special to you. It happens naturally, doesn't it? Your child amongst a group of children, it always feels special. When your children are playing in a playground and you go and observe them, who draws your attention? Always your child. It's the way it works. That's the way it has worked for your parents and their parents and so on. It's always the way it works. When you go to a school meeting or whatever, you see your child playing in the playground, it's your child who always draws your attention. If there are children playing at a party, singing, dancing, whatever, together, on the stage, doing a performance, your child always takes your attention. That's because to you, your child is very special. But it is possible that one day you can get yourself and elevate yourself to a point where all children are the same. All people are the same. One day you can watch the Olympics without only hooraying for Sri Lanka, where it doesn't matter which country wins. And then there's no competition, only sport. We talked about sport and competition one of those days. Sport is good. Competition is not what's good. Because then there's a victor and there's someone who's defeated. But to get there, we need the Dhamma. So that's why we're here today. So then let us bring our palms together in veneration of the great master that taught us how to get there and become someone who can expand ourselves and shed love and compassion to the whole world. He is the Buddha, the perfectly enlightened one, the one of supreme wisdom. And to his name we make this veneration. And as we do so, let us also remind ourselves that this is not a mere token of our veneration and obeisance, but a pledge of our allegiance to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, to the destination of Nibbana, the journey that takes us there, and the practice that we must all undertake by ourselves to achieve that great goal. So with that in mind, let us chant the Namaskar. Take refuge in the Noble Triple Gem, observe the precepts, invite the sentient beings to join us and witness this meritorious event and listen to the Dhamma and make a start to today's sermon.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Most of your friends and family will be planning for the end of the year, 31st night and all that. What's your plan for 31st night? It's a special day anyway, isn't it? The 31st? It's the end of the year. What is the year? Who decided that that was the end of the year? Whoever decided that the first was the start decided that the 31st was the last. In a circle, where's the start and the end? 365 days of going around the sun, right? So where do you start that circle? So this is all convention, as I'm sure you know. I need not explain that to you. This is all very conventional. And there's nothing wrong with that, per se. Convention is good. As long as we understand that this is all convention. The problem is when we make that convention, whatever is conventional must remain conventional. If we see that as an absolute truth, that's when problems arise. If you don't understand that the jobs that you do, the positions that you hold, the status that you hold in society, the titles that you have next to your name, right? The relationships that you hold with each other, husbands, wives, all these friends. If you don't understand that all these are conventional constructs, something that we use in our day-to-day existence just to make our lives easier and convenient. If we fail to see that, ladies and gentlemen, that's when we bring problems to ourselves. When we don't fail, or when we fail to see that conventions are mere conventions, then we start to internalize those conventions and we start to make it more than what it is actually. And then we expect something absolute from those conventions. Like, for example, take friendships. Friendship is a convention. It's a convention because two parties have to agree that they're friends. You can't be friends with someone who doesn't want to be friends with you, can you? Just because you want to think that Elon Musk is your friend, it doesn't mean he's going to be, doesn't mean there's a friendship there. I mean, you might like that, but why doesn't that work like that? See, you go around telling people that Elon Musk is my best friend. What do people say? They will laugh at your face. But if Elon Musk's neighbor goes around saying that, then perhaps they might say, okay, possible. Because it has to be a two-way street, right? So it's a convention. Meaning two people have to agree. That's when there's a friendship. So, what qualifies you to call your wife your wife? She agrees to it. That's why she's your wife. What if she doesn't? What if one day she decides, no, I will not have you call me your wife? Then it will not matter whether that is what you want to call her. No, that relationship will no longer be what you think it is, because it's a convention. These are all conventions. That's what I want you to understand. Everything you see here is a convention. See that pot over there? Or a flower vase, if you want to call it that. What shall we call it? A vase or a pot? A vase? Vase, okay. You call that a vase. That's a convention. Because it is clay formed in the shape of a vase. The fact that it's clay is what's absolute about it. So a potter chose to shape the clay up in the shape of a vase. Therefore it is now a vase. But if you dropped it from that same height, if you took away the support that it has right now, whatever is holding it up, if you took that away right now, it would no longer be a vase. So that's a convention. This leaf, it's a convention. This is made of cells, plant cells. These cells are yet again made of other molecules. These molecules together form these cells, which in turn form these structures, which in turn form these leaves. But that's a convention. You could deconstruct this and get closer to its absolute realities. Then this saucer, this is a convention. This microphone, it's a convention. The fan, this is a convention. What about this robe? It's also a convention. Because we choose to call this a robe, and string has been woven together to construct this. You and I, we call this a robe. But if we present this cloth to someone who doesn't understand what a robe is, they might use it as a rug, might they not? But you wouldn't even dream of thinking something like that. In fact, if you saw a robe on the floor, what would you do? No sooner than you see it, you'll pick it up and fold it and put it somewhere. And you might ask, who put it there? Is this a Swaminathan's robe? you get really worked up about it. But not someone who doesn't understand that this is a robe. So is this a robe then? Is this a robe? It's only a robe to you. Then therefore it's a convention. So what about the body that's wearing the robe right now? What is that? Is that also not a convention? Am I human? Am I male? That's also a convention. Because to a four-legged beast, I'm just food. I'm not a monk. All of this is convention, ladies and gentlemen. Let's not be fooled. Let's open our eyes and understand convention for convention and absolute truths for absolute truths. That's why when the Buddha outlined the absolute truths, he never talked about these things. He didn't talk about vases, he didn't talk about leaves or fans or robes or human beings. He didn't talk about any of those things. Here's what he talked about. He said chitta. He said chaitasika. He said rupa. And he said nibbana. These were the four things that he presented as absolute truths. Thoughts, mental factors, form, and nibbana. The four absolute truths. You may have heard of these four in the past. Chitta, chaitasika, rupa, and nibbana. When you study Abhidhamma, this is in the very first chapter. That is not an invitation to go study Abhidhamma. It's not necessary. I'm just saying. Just for your information. So then everything else we see around us is an aggregation of those things. When you aggregate absolute truths, you get conventional truths. That's how things are formed. Take this building that we're in right now. This hall is a convention. See, right now it's a dhamma hall, isn't it? Or is it an exam hall? Is this a dhamma hall or an exam hall? Because I remember the day I walked in here for the first time. And the good doctor was there to show me around. And what did you introduce this hall to me as? He said that this was the exam hall. And the room had been laid out in such a way because they had some exams going on and the tables were laid out in that order. And so it was presented to me as the exam hall. In my mind, I could see the dharmasana here. And I could see the chairs laid out there. And how people would be sat there. And the Swami Nuhasi would be sat here. So I saw a dhamma hall. Which of course he did as well, which is why this then became the dhamma hall. So on Sunday mornings, this is a dhamma hall. And the rest of the week, it is maybe a function hall, an exam hall, maybe a classroom, a meeting hall, whatever. So that is all what? Conventions. Conventions because people agree. People have to agree on something for it to be a convention, ladies and gentlemen. We have a constitution in our country. Right? What is that? It's a convention. We have a country, don't we? To have a convention? What do we call our country? Sri Lanka. Absolute truth or conventional truth? Then why do people fight for it? Why are people prepared to sacrifice their lives for it? I'm just saying why, okay? I'm not saying it's right or wrong. Just saying. There are people who will fight and give up their life for their country. But what they're prepared to give up is their life for a conventional truth. There may be people who are prepared to give up their life for a relationship. Sometimes we don't realize that what we are giving up in exchange, what we are giving up is something that is far more valuable to us than the conventional truths, because we fail to see them as conventional truths. We internalize them as absolute truths. So once again, I'm not suggesting whether fighting for your country is right or wrong. That's not what I'm here to say. I'm just here to show you the facts. So Sri Lanka is a conventional truth. It is not an absolute truth because it is not Chitta, it is not Chaitasika. It is just Rupa. It's not Nibbana, certainly. It's just a bit of land. If you took the earth, if you took the earth and took out all the water, what would remain? Just an interconnected landmass, right? Is it not the oceans that outline our countries and our nations? Now, where does Pakistan start and India end? Who decides that? But isn't there always conflict? So when there was this Elam struggle in our country, that you might have seen those days, there used to be maps, right? There used to be the little pearl-shaped island, and then there would be areas marked as Elam. Remember those days? Perhaps some of you are too young to have seen any of that, but most of you will have. I was very young back then, and I used to ask my parents, what's that country called? Because that's how you mark out countries in different colors. I used to ask my parents, so what's that part of, what is that country called and what's this country called? And they used to say, no, that's all Sri Lanka, but there's a war going on right now. So the battle, the fight was to separate part of this country and for one part of it to be called the Elam state and the other part of it to be called Sri Lanka. So had that fight, had that materialized, there would have had to be a convention. So there was a war, and we all know how that ended and what the bloody war ultimately gave us. Wars don't mean anything, really. But, you know, why did they go to war? See, then you will understand why it's a convention. Think about it, really. Think deep and hard. These are some of those really fascinating things to think about. And you know, you realize, ladies and gentlemen, that there's a funny, it's a big joke at the end of the day. Why did people go to war? Why was there a 30-year-long war in our country? Because they couldn't agree on something. Two parties couldn't agree on something. Meaning, whatever it is they were trying to agree would be the outcome of an agreement. Right? So if they had won, the other party, if they had won, they would have won because an agreement was not able to be come to. So they couldn't come to an agreement, therefore they went to war in the hope that their say wins. And then we would have had a map of Sri Lanka, so it would no longer be Sri Lanka. Part of it would be titled Elam, it would have a separate state, and the other part would be called Sri Lanka. Because they couldn't come to an agreement, they had to fight. Territorial wars. Territorial wars are the outcome of an agreement that cannot be come to, that cannot be made. Meaning, whatever it is that war is about, has to be something to do with a convention. But people are prepared to give up their lives for it. That's why I say you need to think deep and hard, long and hard, before you decide which ones to fight for and which ones not to. You've got to pick your battles. Otherwise you end up fighting for something that you later on realize that really didn't mean anything. Everything you see here is a convention. This color is a convention. You call it red, maroon. That's only because you see colors. Someone who's colorblind will not agree with you. They will let you say what you want to say, but they won't agree with you. What is this? What did I just draw on the board? B? Really? No, I just drew a line and I just drew a bigger. That's it. You call it B. How is this B? Because we learnt at school that this was B. Meaning your teachers taught you, our teachers taught us that when you see this shape, when you see this shape, this work of art, we agreed that we would call it B. Therefore, there was a convention that this would call this B. Then what can you say about the rest of the letters of the alphabet? It's all the same. Then what can you say about the alphabet itself? It's also a convention. So what about the words that you make up with those letters? What is that? That's also a convention. So then words are conventions. So what about the sentences you make with those words? It's also a convention. So let's make a couple of words. You tell me whether they are absolutes or conventions. What's that? Absolute or convention? Convention. You. Absolute or convention? Convention. Because this is a convention, and so is this. Because this is, you know, if I did this. That's no longer O, is it? Now it's a zero. How did it become a zero from an O? Context. Meaning convention again. Right? So this is a convention. Then what's that? Absolute or convention? Convention. So if this is a convention, this is a convention, this is a convention, then what is this? It's again a convention. But you think that this is an absolute, don't you? When you hear this from someone. When someone comes up to you and either writes this on something and gives it to you, a card or something, or a box of chocolates, or gives it to you with a bunch of roses or something, or says it out loud to you, you think it's an absolute reality. You think it'll last the test of time. You think it is timeless. It'll last forever. But these are all conventional truths. Remember, conventional truths are always constructs. In the Pali, we call them Sankata. Sankata. These are all conditioned truths. They're conditioned. See, this is a conditioned truth, ladies and gentlemen. Let me prove it to you. Why are there roses today? It's not February 14th yet. Are there roses? Carnations. Carnations. I don't know my flowers, so you'll have to forgive me. To me, if it's red, it's a rose. That's why my marriage didn't last very long. See, there's a straight line, a horizontal line. There's a vertical line. Sorry? That is horizontal, right? Oh, no, that is vertical. Beg your pardon, yes. I don't know my roses. And I don't know my verticals and my horizontal line. So this is the horizontal line. Thank you. This is the vertical line. No, the other way around. This is the vertical line and this is the horizontal line. Thank you. So, we have one vertical line, one horizontal line. I have another horizontal line. This, although you think is a line, it's not a line either. If you were to look deep within and magnify this, what you would actually see are bits of things like this. If you zoomed in, that's what you would see. Billions, if not trillions, of little dots. So really, this is also a conventional truth. This, the thing that you call a line, this thing that you call a line would also be a conventional truth, because actually what's there are just blobs of black ink. Then if you were to take one of these blobs and zoom into that, what would you see again? Yet more of those. So you can keep on going and there will always be something that makes up something else. That's why scientists are always trying to find the ultimate particle. And they are yet to find it. Science has been advancing for so long and they're yet to find the ultimate particle. That's a discussion for another day. But my point is this for now. This is not an absolute truth. It's a convention. This is also a convention and so is this. Right? So right now you'll tell me that there are three lines on the board. If I take this out. There are three lines on the board. One vertical, two horizontal. Are you already right that time? Okay. If I brought that here, excuse me. Oh, if I brought this line that was there, here, what would you call that now? L. But what is it actually? One vertical line and one horizontal line. But the line itself is also a convention. Yeah? So conventions make up more conventions. Conventions make up more conventions. They aggregate to make up conventions. Then let's bring this line down here. Right now, this doesn't look much like anything. But here's what we'll try and do. We'll shift this line a bit further to the right. And instead of drawing it straight, I'll draw it diagonally. Now what do you have? Now you call it Z. What's actually here though? Still the same stuff. So there's one line. This is no longer vertical, it's diagonal. But there are ultimately just three lines, right? And you know that those three lines are themselves are conventions after all. So conventions now rearranged to make up other conventions. So do you see that as you rearrange conventional truths, you get yet more conventional truths out of it. Let's try this then. We'll shift this further to the right and now we put it there. Now what do you get? Now we get I. So let's see what was the transformation? Initially you had three lines. Then you had L, then you had Z, and then you had I. When you had the L, you had L and one line, spare. We didn't use that. These are all conventions. all conventions formed out of yet other conventions. There is nothing absolute here. But your mind always tries to see absolute truths in conventional truths. Because the mind perceives absolutism in conventionalism. And we'll come to that in a moment, ladies and gentlemen. But there's a profound truth that I want you to get from this. Try and grasp this truth that I am trying to share with you. And then you will see why you suffer. The curse of suffering is upon your shoulders because you try to see when there isn't. You try to see absolute truths behind conventional truths. Because here's what an arahant is. An arahant sees absolute truths as absolute truths and conventional truths as conventional truths. He doesn't confuse the two together. So an arahant understands, he can read just as you and I can read. He understands what a relationship is. He understands this building is a building. He understands all that. He or she understands all that. But he knows that all of these things are conventional truths. He lives with that understanding, having fulfilled that understanding. Let me give you a very simple example. Don't you feel disappointed in life at times? You feel disappointed when you set expectations on things, don't you? Either on people, or events, or physical things, whatever, on worldly things, you feel disappointed because you set expectations. You set expectations because you see conventional truths as absolute truths. That's why you set expectations on them. Say, for example, you ask someone to do something for you. Let's say you lend someone some money as a favor. You lend someone some money. So this man you lend this money to, he takes your money and he promises you that he will return this money to you within 2 weeks. Right? You've all been there. You've had the experience. Typically what happens? Yeah, come on. We know. We've learned this lesson far too many times, haven't we? And yet you keep doing it again. That's okay. No, you're doing it out of the goodness of your own heart. Right? You give. They don't give back. That's for them. The giving part is for you. The not giving part is for them. So, when you give something to someone and you expect them to return it to you in 2 weeks' time, this is an expectation that you place on the individual that you give it to. Because you believe that this man who takes your money will return it to you in 2 weeks' time. Because you believe that the same person, the one who promises you all this, I will give it to you in 2 weeks' time, is the same person that will be there in 2 weeks' time. That's why you even sign a contract with someone. You think that the person you give the money to is the same person who will return the money to you in 2 weeks' time, don't you? If they told you, right, you give the money to me, but you can collect your money from someone else, what would you say? So they tell you, can I borrow some money from you? And they say, I'm not going to pay it back. You can take it back from someone else. What would you say? Go fly? That's what you would say. If you take my money, you've got to give me back my money. Because in your mind, you think that this man who's taking your money will exist for the next 2 weeks. It's the same person that's going to exist for the next 2 weeks. Who's this entity that you think is going to exist for the next 2 weeks? A person. Right? Persons are conventions. Here's what's absolute. Chitta, Chaitasika, Rupa, Nibbana. Where's the person here? There's no person. These are thoughts, these are mental factors, this is form, and this of course is Nibbana. These are the four absolute truths. You're lending money to a conventional truth. A conventional truth is supported by conditions. Those conditions are the conditions when you lend the money to them. In 2 weeks' time, the conditions will be completely different. An entirely different set of conditions will manifest a different conventional truth. So really, the question has to come back to you. What right do you have to expect them to return the money to you in 2 weeks' time? Because they're not the same person. Truth be told, if you go and ask for your money back, they have every right to tell you, you never lent me any money at all. And you would be speechless, because that is the absolute truth. You never lent me any money at all. But that doesn't stop you from setting expectations on them, do you? Does it? You expect them. You expect them to return your money. Why is that? Because you don't see that this person that you lent money to is merely a conventional truth. In your mind, you entitify them. That's what happens. When you entitify a conventional truth, your mind begins to believe that it is an absolute reality. Do so at your peril, ladies and gentlemen. For all these years that you have suffered the 11 great fires, it has been for this one reason and one reason alone. You entitify conventional truths and you make believe that these conventional truths are actually absolute truths, that they are really there. When a man gives you a word, you expect them to be truthful to their word, don't you? We normally say that as well, don't we? Come on, man. If you give a word, a word's a word. Right? Don't we say that? We expect someone to be honest. We expect people to be genuine. We expect people to be truthful. And we expect people, when they make a promise, to keep to their promise. If you're lucky, then that will be so. But it is not right that you expect that. Now you will ask me, Swami Nansa, what on earth are you talking about? This conventional world in which we live. There we go. See, this conventional world in which we live, we have created a myriad of conventions to make our lives convenient. But that is all it is. I'm not suggesting that from here on you don't lend money to someone. Or borrow money if you need it. Right? That's not what I'm talking about. You can carry on living your lives as you do. The problem is not that, ladies and gentlemen. The problem is you set expectations. Expectations lead to disappointment, not lending money. If there's ever a time where you've lent some money to someone out of the goodness of your heart, I promise you, something good will always come back to you. Do good and good will always come back to you. But the problem is, when you think that you lent it to someone and that someone has to return it to you, now you're asking for trouble. Because you deal with entities. But there are no entities in this world. There's only Chitta Chaitasika Rupa and Nibbana. Don't worry. Maybe it made sense to you. Maybe it's just starting to make sense to you. Maybe it makes no sense to you at all yet. Right? Let's continue with this conversation. At the end of this, it'll all start to make sense. The problem you have and the reason you're here is because you suffer. Plenty of times you've had your fingers burnt because you set expectations on people and they disappointed you. No one's disappointed you. It was not right for you to set expectations. So don't you go around telling people, you've disappointed me. They'll ask you, who asked you to appoint? Right? Who asked you to appoint? I didn't disappoint. You deal with entities, that's the problem. In your mind, you create entities out of conventions. So you're asking for trouble. This is a concoction for problems. Let's take the example again. So here's you. Here's the person you're going to lend some money to. The friend asks you for some money. They want to borrow some money from you. Well, they're your friend for now. Why do I say that? Because you haven't lent the money to them yet. The moment you do that, is the start of the end of that friendship. How many times have you had this experience? Enough and more times, right? Let me explain to you why that happens. The problem's not with them, the problem's with you. Is it okay for me to say that? The problem's with you and it's not with them? Because if the problem's with them, bring them here, you go home. And I'll talk to them. You have come here because you realize that there's something wrong with the way you think. That's why you suffer, and you want Swami Nuhasa to help you to come out of that way of thinking, right? To change your perspective about something. Something's wrong with the way you think. That's why you suffer. And I'm trying to explain to you what is wrong with it. If you are dead certain that the problem's with them, ask them to come here. And I'll try and fix them up. Right. Let's see how this works then. We always feel that we work with entities. That is because of jati. Put your hand up if this is the first time you've heard this word jati. From me or in these sermons, because in case there's a new person in the audience today. No, you're right. You've all heard this before. You know what I mean by jati. Right? Jati is a process of the mind. Okay, thank you, sir. Jati is a process of the mind. Thank you. We know how chittas arise. When the eye comes into contact with an object, a chitta is born. Right? But as a chitta is born, if there's ignorance in the mind, then we have a sense of self that is created in the mind. This is not a self, but a sense of self. So just to very briefly help you identify this sense of self, it is what makes you feel that you are unique. Aren't you unique? At least, isn't that how you feel? That you are unique? Right? So if someone touches your hand right now, you feel that someone else has touched you. Right? That feeling is a sense of uniqueness. But if you touch your own hand, you don't feel that, do you? This is also matter. Their hand is also matter. But now this matter belongs to two individuals. That individuality is a product of your sense of self. So actually, we are not individuals at all. We are not individuals at all, ladies and gentlemen. We are not individual. We are common. We are all very common. But we have a sense of self that works in our minds, which keep reminding us, which keep telling us that we are very unique individuals, we have a personality, and this is us, this is me, this is I. It's not the word I, but the feeling of I. That feeling is created in the mind. This has to be created in the mind. It is not natural. It has to be created in the mind. So this process of creation is what we call Paticca-samuppada. You will have heard of the word, the name Paticca-samuppada. That is how the Buddha explained how this sense of self is created in the mind. So when Paticca-samuppada occurs in your mind doesn't remain just a mind, just a thought. It becomes a thought that has an individual in it. So when you do something, you feel like there is you who's doing it. There's a doer in the doing. When you experience something, you feel that there is someone who's experiencing it. When you observe something, there you feel there's an observer, not just an observation. Yeah, so when you touch something, you feel there's someone who's touching and who's someone who's being touched. These are all products of the process of jati or Paticca-samuppada. Okay, so I'm going to draw it like this just to represent the fact that this is a chitta, a thought that occurs in the mind, and this is the sense of self. So if, what would that be then? A chitta without a sense of self, we can call that an arahant. That is the main difference between an arahant and a non-arahant. So in the arahant, you don't have a sense of self. So they don't have a sense of individuality. They don't have a sense of self, right? And therefore they make no effort to preserve themselves or protect themselves or fight for themselves. That is why they have no desire to live. And neither do they have a desire to die. They're not either way inclined. They're just equanimous. Whatever comes, they're okay. Because desire is born out of the sense of self. Because it is the sense of self that is the root of all desires. Because the sense of self is what gives you a dimension through which you begin to identify unique things in this world, such as individual objects. It is what converts conventional truths to absolute truths. It is your sense of self that does that. Right. So that's a crash course on that. Let's come back to this. So your friend, for now, and you, he's asked you for some money. You're very kind, you're very gentle, and you're always very helpful. So you want to do this favor for your friend, so you lend them some money. While you're doing this, in your mind, you actually see this as what's going on. But actually, this is only a conventional drama. Now I want you to try and see behind the veil. This is the drama. Okay? This is only a drama. This is not the truth. None of this is actually going on. There is no you to give any money to your friend. This is all drama. But in a worldly context, this seems so natural, so real, and we've done this so many times. On another instance, it could be this is the bank. You've gone to the bank to borrow some money. And then the bank gets you to sign some paperwork and they say, right, you have to pay, this is the payment term, you have to pay it back within this time. And if you default on your loan, what does the bank do? If you default on your loan, what does the bank do? They'll come back, they'll come after you for your money, for their money, right? That is because they don't understand the dhamma. Bring the bank manager here as well. Bring the bank manager here and I will explain to the bank manager that the bank never lent you any money. But then, you must also understand that you never deposited any money in the bank either. But this is why I say, this truth is only for the sake of Nibbana. Don't go and try and live this in society. Okay? This is just for Sunday mornings. This is medicine. This is medicine for the ailing mind. Don't try and live this out there. Then life would just be mayhem. People would not be able to live. The whole world would be in despair, right? And the whole system would collapse and it would just be disaster. So when we live in the world out there, ladies and gentlemen, we must conform to whatever conventions are there. So that's why we sign contracts. There are legal agreements. In absolute terms, none of them actually make any sense at all. What legal agreements? What's legal? That's just a convention. Because what's legal is also right by a book. And who wrote the book? The lawmakers wrote the books. And that is an extension of the Constitution. So who did that? Again, an agreement. So all of these are supported by agreements. Then therefore they're not absolute truths. But absolute reality is for your sake to get to Nibbana. But if you fail in that task of understanding and realizing the absolute truths, then you come back into this world, and once you are here, now you have to live by conventional truths. So if you are sick and tired of living by conventional truths, there's only one thing you can do, that is understand, realize the absolute truths, and therefore not come here in the first place. This is what they call Vaulai Gedira. The bat's home. Right? Once you're in the bat's home, what do? You hang by your legs upside down. It's the way it is. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. So now you are in this world, you've got to do as worldly people do. That's why even an arahant would only walk on the pedestrian's side of the road. They don't go around questioning what pedestrian side. This is just rupa. So why does it matter which way I walk and which side I walk on? Because then there'll be a truck that will come at him. And then he will have to suffer. Physically at least. So we can't do that. So this is a very normal, very average, very common, conventional agreement. My problem is not with the money lending or the money borrowing. It's not with that. My problem is this. You are bound to be disappointed. That is the problem. That disappointment we can fix. How nice it would be if you could lend money to someone, and if they default on that, if they don't pay it back, you don't be disappointed at the end of the day. Wouldn't that be nice? Maybe as I say this story to you, you are already thinking about all those times where you lend money to people. Like you gave Sam 5,000, you gave Tom 6,000, you gave your sister 20,000, you gave your aunt 500,000, and you know they still not return the money to you. Already you are thinking about all those times where you lent money to people and they never return it to you. And even today, you know, the wound hasn't healed yet. Right, the wound's still there. That's the part I'm trying to help you fix. So here's the drama. Let's see what's really going on. Here's what's really going on. This is you, a chitta. Whenever you commit a karma, meaning whenever there's a chitta with jati, that's when a karma is committed. Okay, that's why in here you don't get karma. An arahant commits no karma. If these two things are equivalent in every other way, the only difference being the jati, then jati is the karma. Intention is born there. So what happens, ladies and gentlemen? You have your karmic strand. This is not something you can see. This is only a visual representation of how karma works. When you commit a karma, which is what you're doing right now, because you're doing a good deed, this is a meritorious deed, you're helping someone who needs your help. Okay? When you do that, we call it dana, charity. It is the first of the 10 meritorious deeds. Do you know your 10 meritorious deeds? What are they? Dana, Sila, Bhavana. That's right. That's it. Okay, that's a lesson for another day then, no? You need to know what your meritorious deeds are so you can do them as much as possible. Now I'll talk about the meritorious deeds another day. What are the 10 meritorious deeds and how you can do them in your day-to-day lives. But at least you know 3 of them. Dana, Sila and Bhavana. Dana is charity, Sila is virtuousness, and Bhavana is contemplation. It matters not how you sit to do it, it's the contemplation of Dhamma. Okay? Cultivating morality, cultivating virtue, cultivating the Dhamma. This is all Bhavana. Anyhow, so coming back to this, the first of the meritorious deeds, which is charity, this deed is being committed right now. As the money is, you know, it doesn't actually have start with the money being given. Even as the person's thinking about how much, how, you know, can I afford to do this? Where can I find the money to do this? Right? As he starts to think about all this, because all these thoughts are themselves meritorious. Aren't there times where you really want to do something, but you can't because you don't have the means to do it? Like someone asks you for some money, or maybe some food, or maybe for something else, and you know, if you had it, you would do it. But you don't, therefore you can't. Right? Genuinely, there are times when that happens. Even then, ladies and gentlemen, just the thought of wanting to help and the desire to help, the intention to help, is there. Therefore, that earns you merits. Even if you didn't have the object that they seek. But if you had it, then even better, because you can earn more merits out of it. Well, on this occasion, they're asking you for some money, and you have the money, so now you're preparing for it, you're planning, you go to the bank to withdraw the money, right? This is to go and give to your friend, so on. So all of that earns you merits. So here's what happens. Every time those chittas arise, you are putting good stuff into your, let's call it the merit bank, if you want. We call it the karmic strand. Karmic strand because, or a karmic pool, it doesn't matter which you call it, this is where all your karma accumulates. It doesn't take up space, this is just energy. Okay, you can think of them as just packets of energy. Each of these packets are a product of your thoughts. So as the thought of charity, the intention of charity is working in you right now, you are generating your karma and that goes into your karmic pool. The truth is, end of story. That is all that's happening. What's going on here then? Let's assume that this friend is actually a genuine person. He really wants to borrow this money and he has intention to pay back. Okay? In his karmic strand also, he is accumulating karma. Because he's now taking your money, but he wants to pay you back. He's accumulating karma. So there's no question here whether that is demerit or merit, because he's just borrowing your money. If he has intention to pay, then you can't say that is demeritorious. But let's assume that actually he's deceiving you. This is all just a deception. He doesn't want to pay you back. He's just tricking you out of your money. In that instance, what he's doing is actually accumulating demerit. Just as when you were thinking about lending the money but you didn't have the money with you, you could still earn merits. Like I said earlier, I would if I could. Even that earns you merit, right? In the same way, although this person has no intention to pay back, and it's not the time to pay back either, but in his mind, as he's coming up with a plan, or you know, he's conniving to not lend the money back to you, already demerit is being accrued here. Let's understand this part, because this is really important. There's really no relationship going on here, although we feel that there's a transaction going on here. These transactions are all you and your karma. This is where the transaction happens. There's no transaction going on here. But you sign the paperwork? Here, right? The agreement you sign? Here. I pay you, I give you this much, and in this time you return this much back to me. This agreement although happens here, in the karma world, there's no transaction going on between two people here. This karma happens for you in your own karmic pool, in your own karmic sphere, and for this individual, it happens in their own karmic sphere. Therefore, your transactions are not with each other, but with your own karma. Now, how do you hide? Where can you run? Let's go back to this guy who's not being genuine. He's trying to trick you out of your money. He can run from you, of course. Right? He can run from you. And he may even choose not to return the money to you. But the thing is, this deal is only a piece of paper. This agreement is not worth the piece of paper is written on. Because in the karmic dimension, this piece of paper means nothing. In the karmic dimension, all that matters is the intentions that happen in this mind as well as in this mind. Here is where you see you reap what you sow in its inaction. See, you sow and you reap. This part here, this chitta, is a product of one of these karmas. It's when one of these karmas come to fruition, that's when a chitta is born. When a chitta is born, and if a karma is committed in that chitta, that karma goes back up into the karmic strand. This is how this process keeps on recycling. So actually, ladies and gentlemen, you are actually a self-sufficient karma vipaka process in itself. You don't need any external stimulus or external support for karma and vipaka to work. You, by yourself, is self-sufficient in your karma. This is a self-contained unit, this karma and vipaka process. That's why the Buddha asks, na antalikke na samujjamadde na pabbata na vivaram pavissa. Can you go and hide in the depths of the oceans to run away from your karma? Can you go to the end of the world to run away from your karma? Or go and hide yourself in a cave to save yourself from your karma? Maybe climb up Mount Everest, where no karma can touch you or reach you? Is there such a place? What is you after all? Your karma come to fruition, right? Do you see the irony there? Someone who says, I am going to go and hide myself in a cave where my karma can't reach me, is just a big joke. Why? Who's that I who's going and hiding himself in a cave? That is karma coming to fruition anyway. Because if you were able to totally and completely isolate yourself from karma, then you would not be there to hide. I don't know whether you get the point I'm trying to make here. Here's what people want. To be somewhere, hide somewhere from the bad deeds that they have done and from that coming to vipaka, right? But who is that person who wants to hide from their bad deeds? What is this after all? This chitta. This chitta is karma coming into fruition in the first place. Here's what people want. I want these chittas, but only the good ones, not the bad ones. All those bad deeds I did, I don't want them to come to me. But they're all being fed from the same pool. So you can't cut this off. Because you can't cut this off, you can't pick and choose your karma. When the environment is right, your vipaka grows. But when we live in this world that we are in which we are, and we don't see the absolute realities that are going on here, chittas, chaitasikas, rupas, and nibbana, and how karma works, when we don't understand that, we think that our connections, our transactions are with each other. Don't be fooled. This piece of paper is very deceptive. This is only an illusion. You expect this person to honor this agreement, don't you? Don't you? That is the problem. You expect this individual to honor this agreement. So when they don't honor this agreement, what would you do? You might go and chase them for it, or you might take them to court for it. They say, hey, see, we agreed that I would lend you the money and you'd return it to me at this interest rate. And you have to keep true to the terms of the agreement. But little do you know that the agreement is not with each other. The agreement is with you and your karma. For this individual, for him and his karma. Therefore, can I ask you a very simple question? If someone wrongs you, is it your place to punish them? What do you say? If someone has wronged you, is it your place to punish them? Are you being truthful to me? Yes? If someone has wronged you, is it your place to punish them? Then I'll ask you another question. Has anyone ever wronged you? You didn't see that coming, did you? What was the first question I asked you? If someone wrongs you, is it your place to punish them? And you say no. Because you'll say, no, Swaminas, it's not my place to punish them, because their karma will punish them. Then my question, the second question to you is it they who wronged you? Is it they who wronged you? Then you were wrong to put the wrong kind of karma into your karmic strand. It was not they who wronged you. Then who is it you have to forgive? See, people say, right, okay, I forgive you. Forgive who? Who are you going to forgive? If there's anyone to forgive, it's not the other person. Try and forgive yourself. Because you are the only one who's done wrong to you. No one else has. So that's why I repeat what I said earlier. You are a self-contained karma vipaka unit. You are a self-contained karma vipaka unit. None of these dealings are with each other. But you are very often fooled by these paper agreements. You know, when it comes with that seal, right, and the dotted line, and the terms and conditions, and the dates, and the stamps, right? You think, oh, that's the real thing, that's the real deal. And you seal it, you laminate it, you put it into a locker, you put it into a safe, and you lock it with a key, right? And put it in another safe and lock it in another key. Because, you know, you guard this with your life. Why do you guard it with your life? Because you think that's the agreement. Because you think my agreement is with the other individual. This is where the transaction is. So if I lose this, I will have no say here. I will have nothing to prove that we formed an agreement. You don't need any proof, because the proof is up here. So, then by extension of this, let me ask you another question. If you lent some money to someone, must it be them who return it to you? If you lend some money to someone, must it be they who return it to you? What does your instinct say? Conventionally, yes, right? If I lend someone some money, they must return it to me. Isn't that what this contract says? That's why when you go and borrow some money or lend some money, they check your identity. Yeah? So that they can make sure that it is lent to the right person and that individual returns the money to you. Because you're worried that they might run away and not return your money. You being deprived of your money is not something they are going to be doing. You being deprived of your money is not something they are going to be doing. You being deprived of your money is something you have done for yourself before. What is God? Give or deny. So, if you are denied of your money, who's done that? God's done that. Where's God? Can't you see God up here? I have drawn God on the board. See? All of this is God. What you have given, you get. What you have denied, you are denied. When you don't understand this phenomenon, you think that your agreement is with someone else. It is because people don't understand this, now we need courts. Now we need courts so that we can go and argue our cases. That's why we need lawyers. That's why we need lawyers. Because people don't believe in karma and vipaka. Because someone's wronged me. Therefore, I must seek compensation. From whom? From the person who has wronged me. Who's the person who's wronged you? Who's the person who's wronged you? Who? Yourself, indeed. Okay, then if you seek compensation, who must you seek compensation from? Huh? Yourself. What's the best way to seek compensation from yourself? What's the best way to seek compensation from yourself? Do good. Do good. That is the best form of seeking and serving compensation. You're only denied good because you denied good. If you can understand what I've just explained to you, ladies and gentlemen, your lives will become so much easier and so much simpler than what it used to be until this day and this moment. What grudges, I ask you, what grudges? What revenge? What revenge? So now when you are reminded of those people who never returned your money to you, if until now you were always thinking to yourself, oh, that guy, if I ever catch him, if I ever see him somewhere, right, I'm going to tear him a new page and I'm going to somehow get my money back from him. Don't worry. You don't need to get your money back from anyone. Your money will come back to you, maybe not in the form of money. It'll come back to you in some way when you need it. See, money is not, you know, money is just a convention. When you really help someone by lending them some money, it's not, that is not the intention. It's not money that goes into your karma. You know, you don't have like a account up here that has a number of dollars next to it or pounds or rupees next to it. It's not like that. The number, amount of money you have lent is not up there. There's no account of that. Actually, what you're lending when you lend money is an enabler. That's what you're lending. You enable something, isn't it? Let's say, you know, there's someone who's struggling to make ends meet. And they come up to you and ask, you know, I'm struggling to pay my rent this month. Please, can I borrow some money? You might physically hand over some money to them. It might be, you know, real cash. But there's no record of that up here. The amount of cash you've given is not up here. What you've really done is enable them to not get kicked out of their homes. That's what you have done. Now a record of that goes up here. It's not the cash. That's why we don't care about cash anymore. It's not about the money. That's why, you know, I don't charge you for these sermons. I don't need that. But I enable you. I enable you to come out of suffering. So when I do that, what happens to me? If I do it genuinely, enabling you to come out of suffering, what does that do to me? Then I am enabled to come out of suffering. If I put someone in suffering, then I deny them of their joy. I deny them of happiness. I deny them of a fulfilling life. If I ever do that, then that is what comes back to me. Do yourselves a favor, ladies and gentlemen, and live by this. Do yourselves a favor. Let not the world teach you otherwise. We don't learn about these things at school, unfortunately. They don't teach this for science, they don't teach this for math, they don't teach this for these subjects that we learn at school. I learned Buddhism at school, but not this in this profoundness and not at this depth. Maybe we were too young to be taught these things, perhaps that's why we never learned it at school. But I graduated from school, I came out of university not knowing anything about this. Meaning I was a failure. The education system was a failure. Perhaps they taught it and I was asleep in class, I don't know. But 13 years of school and then some more years at university, and I never knew that this was what was right. I was still prepared to go after people who had lent money to, getting them to get me to pay back to me. If someone would ever encroach on my property, I was prepared to file a lawsuit against them. Not that I ever needed to, but I would have done if I had to. Because I always thought that our interactions are with each other, not so. I'll take this conversation one step further to convince you just a little bit more why I say that these interactions are not with each other. Right? You don't need to take it for at face value or just because I say so. I will prove it to you why I say that these interactions are not with each other. This each, others, they're all mental constructs. They don't actually exist. Are we clear on this before I move on to the next chapter? Are we all clear about this, what I've just explained here? As difficult as it might be to do in the conventional world in which we live, can you do yourselves a favor and contemplate on what you have learned here the next time someone runs away with your money? I know it's going to be difficult. Right? And if it's something that you needed to pay your own rent, I understand you might have to go after them and ask them to pay your money back, because you can't go to someone random and say, you know, I lent some money to this guy, can you give me it back? In this conventional world, it doesn't work like that. I get that. But let God do God's work. Let us not try to be God. Let God do God's work. Let us do our work. See, I have never been hungry from the day I was ordained. And I have immense gratitude to all of you who have ensured that I have never been hungry. Whilst I say that though, I know that there are monks in other parts of the country, in other parts of the world, who struggle to find a meal a day. Sometimes they may have to go for miles at a stretch on Pindapatha, but hardly get anything. Is that the devotee's fault? How can you be served if you haven't served? Right? We have an example from the Buddha's life itself. You remember the kauma? Oil cakes, I think they're called. Kaum. I prefer kaum. What? Oil cakes. Kaum. As that kaum was offered to the alms bowl, and then the Venerable Kashyapa Thero followed him. And what did that mother do? She ran back to the Buddha and said, "Can I have my cake back, please? This is not for you." At which point, the Buddha extended the arms and said, "Yes, please, take back what doesn't belong to me." So she retrieved the kauma, took it back and offered to Mahakashyapa Thero. And the Buddha didn't stop there. He went on to explain why it happened that way. That was a good lesson for all of us. Even the Buddha was denied that kauma, because he looked back at the last 91 eons of his existence in samsara, and he realized that to that particular lady, nothing had been offered. Nothing had been offered. Therefore, there was no reason for anything to be offered to him. Therefore, what had not been offered, there was no way for to come to him. So if that is true for the Buddha, then of course that would be true for all of us. So in the same way, as I said, over the last 8-9 years of my ordained life, there's not been a day that I've gone hungry. And whilst I have immense gratitude to our devotees who have always looked after us with such devotion, that is only half of the story. The other half is, I have served. And because I have served, today I am being served. So permit me to take half of the credit. So if I am denied, what is the compensation I should seek? Serve. Simple as that. Therefore, our interactions are not with each other. There is such a thing called sansaric transactions. Sasara ganudinu. That's another dimension to add to this conversation. Because it would be perfectly valid for you to ask, well, the Buddha hadn't offered to that lady, but had he not offered anything at all to anyone? So could it not have come from his karmic pool? So there is an added dimension there. This is called how this chitta, shall we say, chitta, what's an English word for this? Have we called it a generation of chitta? Not generation as in to generate, but one coming after the other. The lineage of chitta, shall we call it that? Okay, so these things. So this would be one. Now you see, immediately as I draw this on the board, you're thinking, isn't that an individual? Because we feel that way, that this is an individual who's been coming in samsara. And then this is another individual. So if their paths have never crossed, then aren't they two individuals whose paths have never crossed? No, that is not what this is. There was never an individual here, and there's not an individual here either. To explain this to you, I'm going to have to get into further depths of the Dhamma, which I'm not going to do for today. Okay, but for the time being, because if I do, then all of this will just be a complete pickle in your head. But so we'll take it one step at a time. But there's a perfectly valid explanation here, and I will talk to you about it one day. There isn't a point in just throwing facts at you, is there? What's the point? This is not a Dhamma school, this is a life school. I only want to give you something that you can take away and practice and make use of, not just give you Dhamma facts. But I want to highlight the fact that if at this point you have a question, didn't the Buddha offer anything to anyone? I mean, of course, he's the one who's offered the most in all his life in samsara. So how come that karma was not legitimately his to take? If he had offered to someone else, if the transaction is not with each other. There's a reason for that, but I will come to that another time. But for the time being, I want you to appreciate this, that these transactions are not with each other. These transactions are with oneself. That is why, no matter how good you might be, if I have not served, then I will not be served. So, for me to be receiving anything at all, two parts have to come together. The goodness of your heart, as well as my vipaka, to receive. It's like the bank can't pay you interest if you don't deposit money into it, can it? No matter how good or how high the interest rates are. Right? They can be a really good bank and they pay you a very high interest rate, but first you have to deposit something. Otherwise they can't pay you back. Then, where were we? We talked about lending money. Where were we? This one. So this we are going to come back to on another day. I was talking about this sansaric transaction, sasaraganudinupat, how there are interconnections between two strands, chitta strands, but that's a dimension that we have to bring into this conversation, but I will do that another time. For now, I want you to understand that these transactions, you needn't fear that someone might run away with your money, is the gist of this conversation. Because even if they do, the fact that you have offered remains etched in your karmic pool. That will never be erased until that giving has been given to you. That will always remain in your karmic pool. Aren't there times where you sometimes wonder how people and why people come and help you just out of the blue? There's no reason for them to help you, and you wonder, how come this man is so nice to me? I've never given him anything at all. This is the first time I've seen him. I hardly know him. How come he's so helpful to me? And you wonder why that is. See, that is where this is coming into fruition. For this to happen, your good karma to come to vipaka, there is a contribution from this part. I'm not denying that. There's a contribution. Let's extend this particular example. We are almost at the end of the sermon, but I'll conclude this before we finish. See, this person, if he was genuine, he would take your money with the intention of returning it to you. Right? That would be a genuine borrower. Meaning the goodness of his heart is conducive to your good vipaka being drawn. If he was an evil person, if he was a con man, then he would not have intention to return your money to you, in which case he might run away. That's why it's a blessing to be around good people. Because what do good people do? Good people reflect your good vipaka on you or at you. That's what good people do. Then what do bad people do? Why do your parents say don't spend time with bad people? People who sin. People who are vile, wicked and vicious. It's because they reflect your own bad vipaka on you. Not the worst man in the world could bring you a bad vipaka that you have not accrued yourself. Okay? You cannot be served something you haven't cooked yourself. But at the same time, not the best saint in the world can serve you goodness that you have not committed yourself. So the Buddha can only serve you what you have cooked for yourself. Angulimala can only hurt you if you have hurt others. So what happens when we interact with other individuals in society is they become a conduit. That is what happens. They become a conduit for our own vipaka to come to us. So there are two types of conduits. There are good ones and then there are bad ones. So the good conduits, what do? They siphon good vipaka. They attract good vipaka. That's why I always say, try and become a magnet for other people's good vipaka. That's when you are a blessing to others, ladies and gentlemen. See, when we were all looking for a place to do a sermon in Colombo, we found this place. Isn't this a very convenient spot for all of you who live close by? If we had to do this sermon at the monastery, how much traveling might you have to do every day? And the fuel that you have to pay, you would have to pay for. And just the journey and the expense and the effort and all that. Right now, soon after the sermon's over, you can get back home, right? Maybe within half an hour at most. So, who takes credit for that? 50? 50. You got this opportunity because you had merits. But merits alone would not have done it. The other 50% of that credit goes to a good conduit. A generous heart who stepped in to say, right, let me try and become a magnet for your good vipaka. So they stepped forward and said, let's see if you have good vipaka. And then that vipaka, which we had, started to draw through them. Therefore, we have this opportunity. That's the way it works. There are times when people step forward to help us, but no matter what they do, we can't be helped. See, sometimes not even the best surgeon can save your life. You might find a lawyer, you might find a surgeon, you might find a doctor who's the best skilled at their jobs, right? And they have a great track record of success. Every surgery they've done has been a success. Every law case that they have talked for has always been a success. But the one that they come and do with you is a flop. That's not necessarily because they're bad. Because it's always 50-50. Just them being good is not enough. We must have goodness that we have served. It's like we cook our food, someone else serves it to us. So to try and spend time with good people is a very wise thing to do. What am I doing right now with you? I can't take 100% credit for it. I'll take 50, please. But you can keep the other 50. So you can give yourselves a pat on the back for 50% of what's happening here. No matter how good I might be, I would not be able to help you if you didn't have the vipaka. But you see, this vipaka you always had. Maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, you must have had this vipaka. But we were not ready. Our monks weren't ready. Gruhandra wasn't ready. The Swaminvanses weren't ready to be a siphon for those vipakas to start coming to fruition. And then one fine day we decided, right, we are ready. So then, you heard the clarion call. Apparently they're ready. You didn't know what was going on. Someone said there's a sermon in Colombo. You saw some kind of leaflet, banner, maybe on WhatsApp, whatever social media, and said, I should go to that. So you had the merits, but just the dots weren't connected. So someone comes in to connect those dots together. That's why it makes sense and it's a wise thing to do to associate with noble friends. What do noble friends do? They help draw the good vipakas that you have done in sansara. And there's more. Their association continuously feeds you with good knowledge, good wisdom, good insight, the truth. And therefore what happens? Every time you commit a karma, the chances are you do more good karma. Therefore, this pool starts filling up with more of the good stuff. Therefore, now there's more goodness up here. Therefore, the chances are, after you start associating with noble friends, because you do more good, the concentration of good in your karmic pool increases. That's why back in those days, I talked about this last week. When you go to our ancestral doctors, and before they do a treatment, they'd say, go and do something good. Do a merit before you come for treatment. Because what does that do? It increases the concentration of good vipaka. Therefore, the chances that the doctor can save your life or heal you or treat you are better, because you have more good vipaka to now come to fruition and to heal you. See, this is why I always say this Dhamma is to help empower you. Once you understand this, ladies and gentlemen, now you must feel empowered. Because you understand that whatever goodness you want, you can sow. You're not at the mercy of someone else. Now you are your own boss. You get to decide what happens to you in the future. If you want to live a good life, then be good. What you sow, you shall reap. Give, and you shall get. Therefore, there's no need for to hold any grudges or any animosity towards anyone who you feel has wronged you. Because the truth is, no one has ever wronged you. Any wrong that has happened is wrong that you have done to others. Live by this and you will thank yourself for it. That is why once you understand the Dhamma, there's no reason to have any anger or animosity or grudges towards anyone else, because you understand everything that falls on my head was something that I once threw up into the sky myself. Be that a flower or a rock, whatever I've thrown up, that comes back on my head. This is the gift that the Buddha gave me. I used to be someone who would point my finger at others and complain and complain and say, why do you disappoint me? Don't disappoint me, this, that and the other. There were people who used to borrow money from me, but they never returned. And I didn't like that. And I felt anger towards them. But then later I realized, it was not they who were responsible for that. I must have done the same. In relationships, the same principles apply. Don't cheat, for you shall be cheated on. Enough said, right? So if you're on the receiving end of that, if you figure one day that this agreement that you call the marriage certificate or a relationship agreement has been faltered, then don't necessarily point your finger at the other person and say, how dare you do that to me? All they're doing is being a mirror. It's like holding a mirror up like that. See, imagine they had a mirror like this. What's it reflecting? On you. Whatever good you have done, they will bounce it. It'll bounce off of them onto you. Whatever bad you have done, once again, it'll bounce off of them onto you. So here are two things that you can try and do. Do as much good as you can and spend as much time as you can with good people. Try and do these two things, ladies and gentlemen. Your lives will be a remarkable success. What do you think I do? You still have a question as to why I chose monkhood? Well, then your question must be answered now. These are the simple, two simple rules to a good, rewarding, fulfilling and happy life. Do as much good as you can. And number two, spend as much time as you can with good people. Who are good people? People who do good. So if you're someone who does good, then spend time with people who do like you. These are the two simplest rules to or laws to a happy life. Maybe you are someone who does a lot of good, right? I will accept that. Sometimes you come up and say, Swaminas, I'm such a good person, I do all these good things, but how come my life is still so difficult? Perhaps the second part of that you haven't achieved yet. You do a lot of good, but maybe you still surround yourself with people who don't do as much good as you do. Therefore, they are not mirrors that reflect onto you good you have done. Some people's presence is such a curse that they will somehow find some bad karma in your karmic strand. Right? Maybe there's only one in a million, but they will find it somehow. And they will reflect it on you. But then there are some people who are such a blessing, like the Buddha was to Angulimala. See, the last few years of Angulimala's life, all he did was kill. He went on a killing spree, didn't he? But the Buddha was such a blessing to him that in Angulimala's karmic strand, he found one karma that helped him to understand the truth. That is why the Buddha is called Bhagava. He's Bhagyavanta. In other words, he's the epitome of blessing. He's a blessing on two legs. That's all I can say about the Buddha. You can try and be like that. Be a blessing to others. Meaning try and help draw other people's good vipaka. That's how you become a blessing to others. How do you become a curse to others? How do you become a curse to others? Not that you want to, but how would you become one? When would you say that someone else is a curse? Maybe there are some people in your life that you have to live with or come by once in a while at least and say, that man is such a curse. Why would you say that? It's when they always bring you misfortune. Right? They always bring you bad luck. Right? Whenever you try and do something good, they're the ones who will come and spoil it for you. Meaning, what they do is, they reflect at you the bad vipaka of your bad karma. 50% their fault, 50% yours. So when do you say that someone's a blessing? You say, he's such a blessing. She's such a blessing. My life completely transformed after I met that individual. So what did they do to you? 50% to them, but 50% to you. What happened? They were the mirror that reflected on you the good vipakas of your good karma. Why are they good? They're good because they also do good karma. By doing what? Reflecting on you the good vipakas of your good actions. So every time you do that to someone, you're also doing good karma. That's how good breeds good. Goodness breeds goodness, ladies and gentlemen. So what are the two things? This is the take home from today. Number one, do as much good as you can. Number two, spend as much time as you can with good people. Take that away for the new year. That's your New Year's gift from me. Take that with you for the new year, and the next year will be a complete transformation. Every week, sit down, right? Take half an hour every week and just think to yourself, have I done as much good as I can this week? Ask yourself. Right? Were there opportunities that I just let pass by? Were there opportunities that I could have harnessed to do some more good to others? Did I skip those simple, easy to do good deeds? Did I just let them go by without actually taking and making use of that opportunity to do good? Ask yourself. And then the second thing you have to ask yourself, who have I spent my time with this week? Did I spend my time with good people? Or did I spend my time with people who are not good yet? There are no bad people in this world, truly. There are good people and to be good people. That's all they are. A piece of instruction I give to my students when I talk to them is, I say, pick the five people that you want to spend most of your time with, because they define who you are. Five people. Of these five people, pick two who are at least at your level. Two who are at least at your level. If you can't at least at your level, then below you. But three who are above you. So that you are not dragged back by the two. Because we have a duty in our lives, ladies and gentlemen, to help uplift others as well. Those who have not come to our level, just as, you know, those above us do to us. Help us, they help us uplift our lives, don't they? Because if our teachers only associated with people better than them, then what hope would we have? So our teachers always have the compassion to come down to our level and pick us up and lift us up. Right? So they have the compassion to do that. So we must also have that compassion. Therefore, it's fine if you associate with two individuals who you can help to come up to your level. But try and spend at least the most of your time with three individuals who are above your level. If you can't above your level, at least at your level. But if the tables turn the other way around and you spend three of the people you associate with are worse than you and only two are better than you, then you are constantly moving in the wrong direction. Because the influence of those three will be stronger potentially than the two who are pulling you in the right direction. Because the five people who you spend most of your time with determine the kind of person that you are. There's a famous saying, and I can't remember who said it, but I will repeat that. If you want me to tell you who you are, show me the five people you spend the most of your time with. I don't need to see you. I don't need to talk to you. Just show me the five people you spend most of your time with, and I'll tell you about yourself. This is so true. And I have just proven the same to you through the Dhamma. Why it is true, what they say. You know, when the Bodhisattva was doing his austerity for 6 years, he spent his time with five people, didn't he? Konnanyavappa Baddha Mahaname Nasaji. Those five people kept him in his practice. Very stringent, austere practice for 6 long years. And at one point he realized, this is not going to work. So he bid them farewell. He said, your influence is not going to help me right now. I have to find my own teacher. So to those five who kept him in his austere practice, he said, sorry, this is not going to work. It is not what I wanted. I'm just putting myself through intense hardship and pain. This is not succeeding. It's not getting me where I want to be. So I think our paths end here. And so they picked themselves up and they left. So there ended that association with those five. And then he had to associate himself with the Dhamma. So the rest of the time he spent with the Dhamma. And until he became the Buddha. But once he became the Buddha, soon after he established the community of the Sangha. To the very five people who he bid farewell, he went to first and said, I now have the answer. Let me help you. They were not willing to listen to him initially. This man has come back now. Surely in embarrassment, now that he has failed. But then as they sat down and started to listen to him, they realized that it was not he who had failed. But then those five went on to become arahants at the end of the second sermon. Now that five was a good five to associate with. So what did the Buddha say then? Now go, take the truth to as many people as you can and establish the community of the Sangha. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe that the greatest gift that the Buddha ever gave us was the Mahasangha. The Dhamma is in the Tripitaka. Yes. But the Tripitaka is just a book. The Mahasangha is the embodiment of the Dhamma. It brings the Dhamma to life. It makes the Dhamma relatable to us. It is the voice of the Dhamma. The Tripitaka is the script of the Dhamma. But the Mahasangha is the voice of the Dhamma. Spend as much time as you can with those who embody the truth that was uttered by the Buddha. I don't know where they are. You go look for them. I have found my oasis. You go look for them. If you believe they are there, then go and spend time there. If you believe they are there, then go spend time there. The choice is yours. But it is my job to remind you that these are the two things that will transform your life. Do as much good to others as possible. And number two, spend as much time as you can with good people. Try this for the next year. You will thank me for it. No, you will thank yourself for it. Trust me, your lives will transform beyond your wildest imagination. It is what has been happening to me over the last 8-9 years. I decided to do that 9 years ago. And I am living proof that these two principles alone can make such a huge impact on a person's life. Does this make sense to you? Do you understand now that you are a self-contained unit of karma and vipaka? That you need not go chasing after people for the money that you have lent them. It will come to you when the time is right. That there is no reason to avenge those who have wronged you. Right? Make a promise to yourself, ladies and gentlemen. You don't, from next year on, don't ever go trying to take revenge, avenging those who have wronged you. They will have their share of, you know, their own fair share from their own vipaka. Here's what you can try and do. Now this is one step ahead. This is one last thing I'll say for today. Okay? How you can be a blessing to those who have wronged you. Little do they know that when they wrong you, they're actually only doing wrong to themselves. They don't know that, but they do it anyway because they think they can hurt you, harm you, and run and hide from it. If you can, and I know this is not always going to be possible, but if you can, try and save them. Try and save them. I didn't say try and get your money back from them. That is not the intention. Because your money will come back to you. You've already sowed the seeds for that. It's not going to come back to you from them. It's going to come back to you from your karmic strand. Okay? But if you can try and save them, for they have not wronged you, they have only wronged themselves. Now that is pure compassion. Altruistic love is what I call that. Compassion and love with no expectation in return. Someone's wronged you, you want to help them because they don't realize that their karma is going to come and bite them on their own backs. This is the nature of an Aryan. When someone hurts you, harms you, try and help them to escape the demerit of their wrongdoing. Not to seek compensation, not that, don't approach them with that intention. Try and help them to save themselves from themselves. But that is an extra mile, if you can go that. But if you can't, at least cut them some slack. They will need time now, because they're going to be spending a lot of time repenting, regretting, and paying the price for what they have done. We are hasty sometimes in our bad deeds, but at leisure we suffer the consequences. So who is your best friend? And who's your worst enemy? May that lesson be with you for the rest of the year and the new year. Live by that. You'll be glad you did. Right, let's conclude for today then. I have an announcement to make, yes, thank you. So on the 4th of January, which is next Sunday, we won't have the sermon here. We will have the language event that we had planned to do on the 30th November. That was postponed for, you know why, obvious reasons. And so we have postponed it to the 4th of January. The program will start at 11. So if you're there for that, then please arrive by in good time for 11. But I also have some even better news for all of you. Little Britain started here. So it was this is where I first spoke about Little Britain, and Guru Hamdra wanted me to talk to the Dharmishtha Rajagirian group about Little Britain, because you understand the value truly of making this Dhamma available in multiple languages, and particularly in English, because it is the language in which you have consumed the Dhamma. So you all got together, and if you remember, I asked you, it is not your money that we are looking for. Try and get people to come together to support this great initiative. People you know, people from your workplace, others who may be philanthropists or benefactors who are happy to support these kind of initiatives. And so you did. And I know you worked on it together. There was a group that was created into which you made your commitments, and you went talking to people. You garnered support, you rallied up support for people to come together. And we were able to meet the target that we wanted. We were looking for 20 million, wasn't it? Yes. 20 million with which to start work. And we were hoping that by the end of the year, we would be able to reach that target. And the good news is that we have been able to reach that target. Of course, with thanks to all your hard work and endeavors. You know that Little Britain is not for you, right? That is the beauty of it, ladies and gentlemen. That's the beauty of it. Honestly, that is the beauty of it. It is not for you. You know that you're not going to be taking residence there. You're not going to be coming to learn languages there or any of that. You're doing this so that others like you can benefit from the Dhamma. These truths must be explained in every language that man speaks. In English, in Spanish, in German, in Italian, in Greek, in Arabic. And that is why we established this concept of Little Britain. We call it Little Britain, but it's actually the International Language Center of our monastery. But, you know, we affectionately called it Little Britain because the architecture represents the British Parliament, as you might have seen in the literature. So now that we have collected enough funds to get started, on the 4th of January, the same Sunday that I mentioned a moment ago, we will have the foundation stone laying event at the monastery, in the precinct that we have set aside for Little Britain to rise up tall and stand, where many young minds will come, learn these languages, and take the truths that you today are healed by to every corner of the globe. So this is, I made every other announcement yesterday on Saturday's sermon, in the Sinhala one, except for this one. So those who were there yesterday will note that I didn't mention Little Britain. But the language event was mentioned, not this one, because it is you who deserve to hear it for the first time. So the invitation is now made to all of you, because this is your brainchild, this is your project, this is what you have all come together to make possible. Many of you have gone, I can't imagine the lengths that you went to get people on board to support these initiatives, or this particular one. And we are eternally grateful for what you have done. And I think you will be grateful to yourself, after all, after what you have learned today. What you give to yourself ultimately. So the groundbreaking event, or the foundation stone laying event, will be on the 4th. We plan to start it at 8 in the morning. So please be there in good time for that. And we will have foundation stones ready for all of you. So you can all come with us, and we will go to the area that we have reserved for that. You can place your foundation stone and make a blessing. You can be that mirror that I spoke about. Make a determination, make your blessing. And it doesn't matter whether you were able to contribute, perhaps because maybe today is the first day you've heard of this project. And that might be, but that's okay. You're all welcome. Remember, the one thing I asked from you was not the money. What did I ask of you? I wanted you to make a determination that this project would be a success. That has worked, hasn't it? See? So your determination has worked. Your will and your wish has worked, ladies and gentlemen, and for that I thank you. Money will come. Money will come. Money will come when it's time to come. But your love, your affection, your desire to make this a success, that is what beckons everything else to come into place. So you have done that, and therefore you deserve to hear this for the first time, and now you have. So please come along to the monastery on the 4th Sunday. Be there around 7:30 so that we can make a start for 8. And we will all get together, lay the foundation stone, and we will start with the construction of the International Language Center. I can envision, in another few years' time, people much better than me, if not like me, will be taking the Dhamma to every part of the world and teaching people that there is no reason to avenge anyone, that there's no reason to hold grudges with anyone, that what you sow, you shall reap, that God is your own doing. And then they will feel empowered. Young men will feel empowered. Young women will feel empowered. Young children will feel empowered. People will realize that you are your own blessing and you are your own curse. That I see is the path to peace. We can't stop countries waging war against each other. But if we can help man find inner peace, there will be no need to war. There will be no need to fight. The rate at which the world is fighting with each other, countries waging war against each other, all these politics and all that going on, ladies and gentlemen, if we don't do something, there will be no world left in 2, 3, 4, 5 generations to come. It will just be mayhem and sheer destruction. There's too much tension out there. People are all at edge. And everyone's at each other's throat. People seem to be living happily because they have access to all these material things, but inside it's just a festering wound. Those are the wounds that we have to heal. And I see no other path to do it than through the gift of Dhamma. So what you are doing is enabling that. Remember what I said about money? It's not the money. It's about enabling something. Enable and it shall be enabled to you. Enable Nibbana. Enable peace. Enable happiness. Enable freedom. And all such things will be enabled to you. Okay, so next Sunday, don't come here. We won't be here. Please bring yourselves to the monastery. And let's all celebrate the start of something wonderful. The world will thank you. Trust me, the whole world will thank you one day for coming together and starting and launching something like this. Both the channels and a center in which we learn, we practice the language skills that we need to take the gift of Dhamma to all mankind. Remember what Arthur C. Clarke said? On this very soil he said that. Although he wasn't born in our nation, when he set foot here and he decided to call this land home, right? He uttered a prophecy. What did he say? In 2050, the majority of the world's population, I'm not going to say will be Buddhists, but the majority of the world's population will understand the truths. The truth to inner peace. When I was young, I read it in a book. And I was happy, but I didn't feel that I had any part to play in it. I didn't see my future. I couldn't. But my teacher saw it. So he brought me along. And he brought all of us together. And he brought all of us along and said, guess what? That was Arthur C. Clarke's vision. We are the mission. So, let's make that dream a reality. We may not be alive in 2000, come 2050. But it's not our lives that matter. It's the message that is timeless. Let's make that happen. I know one day we will be speaking at the United Nations General Assembly. It will happen. The whole world will one day hear the truth. Someone among you will make it happen. Let it come in time. There's no rush or anything. We are in no rush. The only thing we have to rush is to get to our Nibbana. The rest will come at its own pace. Because the whole world deserves this. Don't you agree? Right, let's leave it there then. The? 31st, yes. Yeah, thank you. So the 31st, as you may know, we have the Medshanti Karma. We'll be doing Metta and spreading it to the whole world. 31st night, I think last year also many of you were at the monastery. I remember there was one sister, the other sister is still here in the audience. She was sat there listening to the talk that I was giving last 31st. And today she's an Anagarika. So, on the 31st, you're all welcome to join the Medshanti Karma program at the monastery. So, on the dawn of the new year, we will be chanting Metta stanzas, which contain the compassion embodied in a stanza. And there'll be a sermon before that to explain to you what those stanzas mean and how compassion is embodied in them so that you can do it out of understanding. And on the first, of course, Guru Swami Nahansi will be there as well. And he will be there to bless us all on the launch of the new year. He will have a special message that he will want to share with all of us. He's been away now for many weeks, too long, if you ask me. So we are all looking forward to hear from him as soon as he's back. So friends, family, if anyone's available on the day, and I know, you know, 31st is a special day for most people for many other reasons. I don't want you to walk away from your familial obligations, duties and responsibilities, right? If you have to be with your family, then please do that. But if now your family has become the monastery, then do that. So my invitation is that. You've got to decide which one is the family. If you can bring your entire family there, then you're all welcome. But please, I once again emphasize this, don't walk away from your responsibilities, because that is not the way we rock and roll. You have to be with your family. If they want you there on the 31st, you know, it's a family get together, you have a dinner, you have a meal, you enjoy, right? That's what you have to do, then that's what you have to do. But if you can, please bring yourself in, and we will be very happy to warmly welcome you all. Because to us, you're already family. So that's on the 31st. All done? Thank you. She's like having an extra pair of hands. Okay, let's do the merit transfer and bring the sermon to a close. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem and creating a conducive environment for all to come along, listen to the Dhamma, practice and embody the teachings of the great master. First and foremost, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasakas throughout the world who have dedicated their lives to practice the path and also preserve the Sambuddha Sasana and the teachings of the Buddha and transfer it down to us in the form of the Tripitaka, which is available to us to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these merits to my teacher Guru Swami Nahansi, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our devotees who, for the sake of merits to help attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on your know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. Let us also transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine, and have always been there to be a moral support when you needed them. Let us also take this moment to transfer merits to your mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, cousins, uncles, aunts, nephews, nieces, your siblings, as well as your teachers and anyone and everyone who have helped you, supported you and assisted you in any way, shape or form. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name, our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path. Let us also transfer this message to those who lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives in natural disasters such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been friends to us, parents to us, siblings to us, those who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in many ways and forms. Let us transfer all these merits we have acquired to all. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may by the power of all the blessings and merits we have earned throughout the day, you and I and everyone who's made this program a success become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahat Dharanin Mahanse in this life itself and in the era of this Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnam midatnva Dvesha ginnam midatnva Moha ginnam midatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetma Mamada siyalu loka Siyalu satvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetma Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetma Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan Sapaleva Nivan Sapaleva Nivan Sapaleva
Tunduange Suishyananta Mahaguna Belen Sielu Loka Sielu Satyoma Nibbana Paramasukhen Sukta Taravetva Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu.